is the esteemed Sister Sahar Jaber. Sahar has an honours degree in Sociology and Communication Studies from McMaster University. She resides in Lebanon, where she studies at the Islamic Seminary. She co-founded Figs and Olives Publications, an Islamic publishing house aiming to provide reliable and impactful resources for parents, institutions and children in English. Assalamu alaikum to you both. Thank you for joining us on the show. Sister Jaber, if I could begin with you. We just saw in the video at the top of the show some of the verses that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has revealed for the Muslims to understand their duties in propagating the religion of Islam. What are your thoughts, first of all, on some of those verses that Allah has revealed?
I think those verses stress on the idea, in fact, that the prophets themselves, their main role in this world was to propagate Islam. That's the very essence and the purpose of a prophet himself. And so what Allah does is He does not stop at the prophet. It is not possible that the prophet was the last one to propagate Islam and then we should continue in our ways. What Allah asks from us is for us ourselves to propagate Islam. إِنِّي جَعْلٍ فِي الْأَرْضِ خَلِيفَةً بِسْمِ اللَّهِ الرَّحِيمِ. And so understanding this verse is that we have a responsibility in ourselves to be a representation for Allah, to be a representation on this earth in the way of God. A lot of individuals in this day and age, especially because of the society we're in, the feminine society we're in, they're very afraid to put on their beliefs or what they actually think would be true to others, because they don't want to enforce anything. They don't want to enforce any religion. But Islam itself says you need to propagate in the way of your actions, propagate Islam, because that's the very essence of your purpose. What's to be a khalifa? What's to be a representation of God?
Absolutely. And there was another a hadith actually that we touched upon in that video, which is the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam saying that Muslims, if they see a wrong, they should correct it by their hand if they can, and if not, by their tongue. And if not, then at least oppose it in their hearts, which of course is the lowest form of belief. What do you think are the duties of Muslims when it comes to enjoining the good and forbidding the evil?
When we talk about forbidding the evil and enjoining the good, the reason why there's different levels is because if you can do it by tongue, it's the best, of course, to speak. But however, we know in this day and age, sometimes someone cannot accept, and maybe even they will put some force on you in a way in which is unacceptable. And so at that manner, enjoining good and forbidding evil will even go towards your eyesight, and so in a way in which you do not show them that you are smiling or that you excel or accept what they're saying. Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq even says, call the people towards Islam without using your tongue, to the point in which your very representation in the workforce, in the community, it's a representation of what it means to be a Muslim, and in force, people are then questioning about Islam. We see, for instance, in Gaza, right now, what's happening. So many are converting to Islam because they are seeing, not by words, not by the tongue, but by the actions, what it means to be a Muslim, and they are being introduced to it in a beautiful way.
Yeah, absolutely. And Dr. Vedadi as well, I would maybe pick up the same point with yourself. Anything to add on that?
I think also one thing I always thought about is those people who are Muslim, from the Muslim Ummah, from the Muslim community, and they don't have the connection to what we're discussing in the sense that sometimes they accept injustice. I think sometimes we have to remember that injustice starts in the heart, and so we need to reevaluate. That's why it goes, if you can't do it by tongue, by hand, by tongue, then the heart, because it initiates in the heart. If your heart is not purely against oppression, it doesn't matter what your tongue says, it emanates from the heart. So that's why it's important that we go back to the root, being the heart, and those who are not emanating against oppression, they need to reevaluate their connection with Islam and Allah, that something is not correct in their heart.
And if I can say with you, Doctor, you know, you're a media professional, you're somebody who has vast experience over decades. I want to get your thoughts in terms of the global media. How, you know, we know that they are controlled by Zionists, or those who are sympathetic to Zionists, or funded by Zionist capital. How do they use that media to defame Muslims and Islam?
So there's various tactics used by media to defame any group. If we look at the Muslim, they use a lot of tactics, for example, stereotyping and generalizing Muslim activities and lumping it with small number of people that may be doing something that's wrong or inaccurate towards Islam. Then they start, one thing they use is framing. So they frame Muslims in a specific way. They use military language when they describe Muslims. So it's a jihad when terrorist act happens and it happens to be a Muslim, but it's a lone wolf or a crime when it's a non-Muslim. They use a divisive to them and us. Mm. They don't accept our values. They don't. When they come to this country, they don't. They want to impose their Sharia onto us. It's them and us. So, and there's also political motivations behind this. It's not. So people always say just Zionism. I think Zionism is one of the puzzles in the jigsaw of anti-Muslim. So capitalism is also part of that. Because what Islam says is promote justice. Mm. And justice is everyone having a fair share in the society they live in. But capitalism is about enriching a small number of people. And the concept of Zionism falls into that. It's used to bring a certain group of people down. Unfortunately, Palestine, but also used outside.
And it's interesting because, you know, in recent years, we have got even more amplified because you've got social media now. So there's people receiving their news or the information in their phones. But we see the same pattern repeating in terms of, you know, social media companies, big tech companies kind of closing down on people or clamping down on censoring voices. Would you agree?
So this concept goes back to, for example, what Noam Chomsky, the professor from America, said, that they manufacture consent. Mm. So before social media in the last 15 years became really popular, they would use it through newspapers and then TV, cinema, radio. And now we have those, but then on top of that, we have social media, which is the one people more engage with more. And we know from many articles and news that came out that the American government is directly in contact with all the major
tech companies,
so Facebook, Instagram, to the point where FBI would give them requests to remove these accounts or shut down people who use these hashtags and so forth and so on. Mm. And we know all of us, I think all of us who watch this program would have realized now, since what happened from September the 7th, a lot of accounts have become shadow banned. Mm. So you go in, you see a post that they've put on and you want to share it, you can't. The option of sharing that account is not possible because the enforcement by anti-Muslim groups has become so powerful that a lot of accounts have been impacted by now. So social media may be supposed to be a democratic
platform. It's definitely more decentralized.
But
people
it's,
have
it's
more
definitely,
voice.
Yeah.
Yeah, and especially as you said, since October the 7th, it has been a case where we've seen the media companies try to control it more, but still, you know, the pro-Palestinian element does get through. Now, Ayan Islam spoke to people in London to ask them their thoughts on the responsibilities that believers have when it comes to these matters.
Okay, it's important and you can practice it in your day-to-day life, and you will do it by the people you speak to, through your actions, through your behavior, how you present yourself. Obviously, as for myself as a Muslim, I wear the hijab, and how I carry myself in public, how I speak to my colleagues, my friends, even strangers in public, even people on the tube who might be watching what I do. All of that is a part of that, and it will show it's combating how others might see us, and I think it is important. It's done that in that way, little bit by bit every day.
Yes, during this time, it's really important to do Jihad al-Tabiyin and to speak up, especially with what's happening in Gaza and the genocide and everything that's being committed. So yes, we do have to speak up more than ever.
I think Jihad al-Tabiyin arguably is more important for the everyday Muslim, even more so than, say, the important figures or the influential figures, because those people, the everyday person, is the one whom the non-Muslims get their impression of Islam from, and they form their idea of this is what the typical Muslim is. Arguably, that's one of our most important duties as Muslims in the West, and it's a very important opportunity we have is to bridge that gap to the non-Muslims. And historically, this was one of the most important forms of da'wah, for example.
The thing is, since 9/11, we thought we'd made a lot of inroads in terms of the media, in terms of representation, in terms of the media understanding our point of view and putting it forward. What we've recently seen with Gaza is that either that was a facade or it's been entirely rolled back, and there's been incredibly Islamophobic outpouring in the media, a very one-sided view, barely any sort of Muslim or Arab or Middle Eastern or Global South voices being expressed, except for example in Al Jazeera and for a handful of other places. A lot of journalists have been removed from their positions, like Mehdi Hassan famously. So it's been an incredibly difficult time, but it's also a time where we must fight back, where we must assert ourselves, assert our point of view, assert our narrative, and champion our cause. 100% is our Islamic duty, whether it's on a micro scale by informing your friends and family and by people that you know in your workplace, or whether it's on the political, on the macro level, whether we're joining political parties or joining political movements and joining protest movements and joining, you know, direct action causes where we're shutting down and blocking what's it called, weapons factories and so forth. It is definitely our duty, especially because I believe there's a hadith of the Prophet, forgive me if I misquote it, it is the duty of every believer he sees injustice to act upon it with their hands, and if they cannot do so with their mouths, then the lowest form of jihad is with their hearts. So certainly if we're able to, we must insert ourselves in all these spaces to push forward our points of view and to stand up for justice and human rights.
So, Sister Jabir, we heard the opinions of some of the Muslim community there in terms of their responsibilities. But in terms of yourself, what do you think are our responsibilities in terms of clarifying, you know, misconceptions and lies that are pushed out by the global hegemony?
I think first and foremost, we have to understand that we have a responsibility in the first place. Many maybe assume that a sheikh or someone that's active on social media, they can take on this role. But in reality, it comes down to God chose for you a position in which you are in a geographic, cultural, systematic area for a reason, because you can have an influence in a way in which someone else cannot. They are not equal. And so to have and recognize that you have an influence in the first place is necessary. Then to understand that you have the language and the ability and the mechanism to do a form of jihad tabiyyin in which other people cannot is necessary. And so in the media right now, with the misconceptions that are happening, this is no different than a time of Sayyida Zainab in which she was going and fixing the misconceptions that were happening against her son, against her brother, Imam Hussein. And we need to take on the misconceptions that are happening against us and be a leader and be a representative towards them. And so it is obligation of every Muslim. It is necessary for us to be an active role, to recognize our abilities, what we have to offer, and then on that basis, actually be an active member in society.
Absolutely.
In dealing with it.
And Brother Reza, yourself, what do you think are the responsibilities of Muslims? And also I'll go to the next question as part of that. Do you think Muslims are doing enough to fulfill those responsibilities?
I think there's always space to improve. We have started in the last 10, 20 years for Muslims to be active in various fields. So if we can break it down into, let's say, five, engaging within media, being participating in media, creating media content. We have a lot of Muslims who are active on social media, but we have some Muslims who are active in the mainstream media. So you have Mo Ammar, who did a show, and he, you know, he's proud to be a Palestinian in it. Mm. We had someone like Rami. Fortunately, some of the shows, like Rami's one, had some problematic elements to it, but you see more engagement. But it's not enough. There's still a need for it. There's the utilization of media. So we need people who are active, positive influences on social media, who don't sell out, if you know what I mean. That's very important. So if I can name a person, for example, I would say Sayyid Hussein Makki. He's a very good influencer on social media. He sticks to his values, and he tries to avoid selling out to mainstream concepts. Community outreach. We used to do a lot of programs like Love Muhammad, which engaged with interfaith and intrafaith. There's also the mosques opening up during Ramadan. Maybe that could be something that happens more often, not just once a year, for example. Mm. And also education and media literacy. I personally participate in a lot of media literacy for our community so then they can engage with their children. Mm. I think that's important because we always think media is entertainment.
Yeah.
We don't realize that ideology is embedded in media.
Yeah.
So unless we can dissect it and take it apart, how do we explain it to our children, to our youth, and to others? So it's very important that we have media literacy as part of it.
I think one thing I always notice is, especially in the UK, but maybe in other parts of the West as well, is while the media is hostile, the culture, especially somewhere like London, is actually very pro-Muslim because there are a lot of Muslims here, and on a micro level, there's a lot of micro-influencing. So you'll see, you know, non-Muslims who, all of their friends are Muslim in school, and they'll either accept the religion or they'll be fasting in Ramadan in solidarity with their brothers and sisters or their friends. And so I think that's also as important as like the higher level kind of media work, is literally influencing your own, yeah, your own people around you, your own communities on a very like modular level. And Sister Sahab, just on a maybe slightly related topic, as a, obviously a sister and a student of knowledge as well in the Hausa, what do you think is a responsibility for sisters, for women especially, in these kind of responsibilities?
So I would take it upon myself. I never intended to be an active member on social media.
Yeah.
I never wanted it. It wasn't something I was aiming for. But my husband and I, who is also an Islamic, in Islamic seminary, we both felt like it was a responsibility upon us to actually take this role, be active members, speak on truth, and actually represent Islam and the hijab in a way in which suits us. Right now, a lot of, as the brother said, a lot of Muslim influencers are sellouts, especially when it comes to females. They think that their role, they've lost purpose of the hijab, and they think their role as an influencer is to be someone that advertises clothing. But you have a bigger role to advertise what it means to be a woman in society, what it means to be a member of Zainabiya, Fatimiyya, with women specifically. The reason in which their role and responsibility through the tongue is more important is because that's solely the role in which a woman can perform. Mm. She does not have the right to go by arms, and so her form of Shahada Tabneen is to go by tongue and to speak and to propagate, especially since a woman has the ability to speak eloquently in a way in which she can actually impact society more so than others. And so whether or not she's influencing those around her and her family members or in society, every woman has an active responsibility.
Yeah, absolutely. And just to stay with you as well, what would you say are some of the projects that you're involved in, or some of the kind of movements that you're involved in on this front?
So specifically on social media, on Instagram, that's definitely where I work the most in order to fix a lot of misconceptions that we have towards Islam. Towards the hijab, towards femininity. Our book publication was literally created and manifested just for that reason. It was manifested because I was afraid if I were to have a daughter, how would I teach her about the hijab in a society in which we'll call a woman a towel head or anything like that. So what's important for us is to actually understand that we have the ability to influence through our work in media.
And that's Figs and Olive
Figs
Publications,
and Olive,
right? Okay, we have to get that plug in there. And yourself, Dr. Vidadi, you're somebody that I've known for many years, and you've always been at the forefront. What are, just very quickly, some of the kind of projects and the work that you've done or are doing to this? And
things that I'd like to promote would be media literacy. So if anyone watched this and is interested in the community to engage in media literacy, so we can empower parents, we can empower individuals, and they can empower their children, which I think is always best. The parents educate their children. I'm happy to work with them. We have some events happening in April. I'm happy to do more. People interested in publishing, as Sister Saha said. Also, I'm thinking about bringing authors who've written interesting content, different worldview from the East, bringing it to the West. And also people who may be interested in films, film festivals, organizing. Al-Quds, we can have an Al-Quds International Film Festival that promotes the concepts of resistance to what's happening in imperialism. So these are things that I'm happy to engage with anyone who wants to reach out. They can use my name in social media. They'll find me, email me, and I'm happy to work with them.
And it's interesting that you say, or you talk about the importance of educating people about the media. I had a very young education. My older sister, when we were kids, used to tell me and point things out in movies. So, for example, we watched Back to the Future, and there was a very negative perception of Libyans and Arabs in the film. And very young, we must have been, I was 7, she was 9, and she said, look how they portray the Arabs in the film. So I had that education growing up. Not everyone might have that in the home. So it's good that you are doing that work for people to understand the agendas behind some of this mass media. And before we leave, I know that both of you have prepared small pieces of poetry. So I'll start with you, Dr. Vidadi, to read perhaps a bit of poetry that is relevant to this topic.
So my poem is from a famous Iranian poet, Persian poet from the 13th century called Sa'di. And it touches on the heart that we discussed and caring about the Ummah in general. And he starts with, and this is on top of the UN building. Human beings are a member of a whole in creation of one essence and soul. If one member is afflicted with pain, other members uneasy will remain. If you have no sympathy for human pain, the name of human you cannot retain.
Thank you so much. And Sister Sahar.
So this poetry is off of Shahida bint Huda, who is the sister of Shahid al-Sadr. If it is said old-fashioned, you are, care not, and steadfastly continue to be. Say, I am the daughter of the message. From its light, I get guidance. My shyness has not prevented me from the highs. It has not shackled my hands, no. And this veil hinders me not from my aim. O sister, the morrow is ours. Go on your path upwards. O sister, the truth rises above the cunning of the aggressors. And in short, this poetry really touches upon the idea that a woman, her shyness, her hayat, her modesty, these are all representation of propagation for a greater truth. And she is capable to do more than to follow what the Western forces her to believe she is.
Thank you so much for that poetry, sister, and Dr. Fidadi. And thank you for your contributions to the show. Sadly, that is all that we have time for this week. And thank you at home. We will be joined by yourselves and other guests next week for another edition of Eye on Islam. Assalamu alaikum.
The limelight. A top Senate Republican from Florida, Marco Rubio, has defended Donald Trump's claim of presidential immunity. Trump faces 88 charges across 4 criminal cases and denies all wrongdoing. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The national broadcaster ABC News has covered this story and tells us more. Florida's Marco Rubio, a top Senate Republican, on Sunday largely defended Donald Trump's claims of immunity against prosecution as the former president faces multiple criminal trials heading into the 2024 election. Marco Rubio, who is reported to be one of the people under consideration to be Donald Trump's running mate this year, seemed to walk a narrow tightrope in addressing Trump and several other issues in an interview with This Week co-anchor Jonathan Karl. Pressed about the former president's argument that he deserves total legal immunity for conduct whilst in office, Marco Rubio conceded that Trump couldn't go out and basically kill one of the members of the staff overnight inside the White House, which the senator called an absurd hypothetical. But he contended that many of the prosecutions against Donald Trump are unjust, and other presidents could face similar problems. I do think there's a legitimate issue here that we need to talk about writ large, Rubio told Jonathan Karl. Donald Trump faces 88 total charges across 4 criminal cases and denies all wrongdoing. The question of his immunity will be argued before the U.S. Supreme Court in late April. Federal prosecutors have challenged Trump's sweeping claim to protection from prosecution for his actions whilst he was president, including his push to overturn the 2020 election results. The Florida Republican Marco Rubio framed the matter differently on Sunday, 24th of March. Do we want to live in a country where basically the opponents of a president can extort them, can have leverage over them during their entire presidency and say, don't worry, once you're out of office, we're going to prosecute you, we're going to come after you, we're going to charge you for this crime. We're living in a country now where basically if you're a president, now you have to think to yourself, I've got to be careful what I do as a president, not even legal or illegal, even on policy. Jonathan Karl noted that you should be careful not to break the law as president, But Marco Rubio pivoted by arguing that partnership is motivating some of the cases against Trump, which prosecutors deny. Senator Marco Rubio also tried to balance his remarks on the 6th of January 2021 riot at the Capitol, criticizing those who assaulted law enforcement, whilst also suggesting that some people were being egregiously charged for merely entering the complex, though doing so required joining a chaotic mob scene involving police lines, broken windows, and the battering of the Capitol building. Jonathan Carl asked Senator Rubio on This Week about his opinion of the 6th of January rioters in the light of Donald Trump praising them as patriots, even indicating he will pardon those who have been convicted if he's elected president again. What I do think is that people that went into the Capitol and committed crimes of violence or had zip ties and all that are different from someone who walked into an open door. I think they should have prioritized and only prosecuted the people who committed acts of violence, Rubio said. Pressed by Jonathan Carl on reports that he is being considered for Donald Trump's vice presidential pick, Rubio demurred, saying he hasn't talked with the former president about that, but would be honored to join him on the ticket this year. When Carl raised the falling out between Donald Trump and his vice president Mike Pence over Pence's refusal to reject their election loss, and the fact that Mike Pence was singled out by some participants on 6th of January 2021, Marco Rubio deflected by touting Trump's overall record as president. Rubio said he felt the country was safer and more prosperous compared to what he called numerous crises under current President Joe Biden. Senator Rubio, who is a top Republican on the Senate Intelligence Committee, also sounded the alarm about the recent attack in Moscow, which has been blamed on Daesh terrorists, also known as ISIS terrorists. Rubio said ISIS could pose a danger to America, in part because of what he called Biden's policy failures with the high number of migrants at the southern border with Mexico. Rubio warned specifically about human traffickers at the border, whom federal officials have said have ties to ISIS or Daesh terrorists. They would love to do what they did in Moscow here inside the United States, and it's something we have to be very vigilant about, Senator Rubio said. Senator Rubio also hedged on Donald Trump's recent comments, however, that any Jew who votes for Democrats hates their religion. The American newspaper The Hill has also covered the same story and tells us more. Senator Marco Rubio, a Republican from Florida, defended former President Donald Trump's claims that he is immune from prosecution for actions surrounding the 6th of January Capitol riots, saying presidents are under undue political pressure from potential future prosecution. Donald Trump's attorneys are set to argue the case before the U.S. Supreme Court next month, claiming the former president should not be charged. I do think there's a legitimate issue here that we need to talk about writ large, especially after what we've seen in the last 3 years, Senator Rubio said on Sunday, 24th of March, in ABC's This Week program. Do we want to live in a country where basically the opponents of the president can kind of extort them, can have leverage over them during their entire presidency and say, don't worry, once you're out of office, we're going to prosecute you, or we're going to come after you, charge you with this crime or that crime. We're living in a country now where basically, if you're president now, you have to think to yourself, I've got to be careful what I do as president, not even legal or illegal, even on policy. Donald Trump's attorneys have made similar arguments in their plea for immunity in a Supreme Court filing last week. They argued immunity would protect the president from de facto blackmail. A denial of criminal immunity would incapacitate every future president with de facto blackmail and extortion while in office, and condemn him to years of post-office trauma at the hands of political opponents. The court filing reads, "The bleak scenario would result in a weak and hollow president and would thus be ruinous for American political system as a whole. That vital consideration alone resolves the question presented in favor of dismissal of this case," the court filing continues. The Florida Senator Marco Rubio and former Trump primary challenger used the opportunity to blast the other legal cases against Donald Trump as politically motivated, specifically calling out New York Attorney General Letitia James. "Look at these prosecutions that are coming about. You've got this lady, a clear partisan in New York, who's basically prosecuting the president over loans. Something that's never been done to anybody before," Rubio said. "That's just one example. They're trying to bankrupt Donald Trump and put him in jail." This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day, from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Southern Africa can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day, from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. Now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Conversation. Hello, I'm Sean Murray, and this is The Conversation, where we take an alternative look at political events and current affairs through an Irish lens. In this show, we hope to pick, probe, investigate, and uncover the stories that you want to hear. We go where mainstream won't go. This week, we talk to a small band of investigative journalists that have taken Ireland by storm. In a country where journalism has a sustained track record in upholding the establishment status quo, are we now seeing the unravelling of a decades-old marriage of convenience? So let's introduce today's guest. Joining me today is Owen McNeil, Paulie Doyle, and Roman Shorthall from The Ditch. Hi guys, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
So first of all, Roman, I could ask you, for the audience's sake, what is The Ditch?
The Ditch, I suppose, is an online investigative journalism website. We set up about 3 years ago. I suppose we felt that there was a gap in the market for maybe a bit more focus on investigative journalism. And we didn't really know exactly, you know, how we were going to go about it, but we knew that we wanted to focus solely on investigative journalism. And, I mean, we started off, you know, kind of digging into public registers and land registry records and stuff like that. And, you know, that seems to be like our, it's still our bread and butter. And that's kind of what we've been focusing on for, nearly 3 years now.
And whose idea was it to come together?
Well, I had worked as a journalist kind of on and off over the last 10 years or so, and I'd worked on, it's going back, it was during COVID, a story about Leo Varadkar leaking a document to one of his friends in a doctor's union, a story that was originally published by Village magazine, and I would have worked on that. And it was kind of from that then, I'd been talking to Roman a wee bit on and off, just kind of phone calls and texts about that story first of all, and then Roman had been doing a bit of journalism himself in the background. Like he comes from a legal background himself, but he'd worked on a few other stories in the background, and it was partly just from these chats and kind of talking about what we thought the game was missing, and that we thought that there wasn't a left-wing news outlet that kind of focused on things like land deals and property holdings and, you know, I suppose from some of our stuff, you know, like undeclared properties, all the rest. And we kind of thought, yeah, fuck it, why not, let's go and give it a go. And, you know, it was kind of, I'd say we would have spoken on and off, maybe might have been 2 or 3 months maybe or so, and we'd been gathering things and building things together, and then Roman had come across, it was a lovely story, and I have to say, like, we launched, yeah, as Roman said, was it March or April, 3 years ago, and Roman had come across, it was during COVID, and Micheál Martin, the most decent man in Ireland, as we all know, had, you know, during a time when there were very strict prohibitions on the kind of events you could hold and attend, he attended a prohibited event down in Cork that was just so happened to be held in honour of his father, Paddy the Champ Martin, who was an amateur boxer. And Roman came across this video of Micheál Martin attending this event, and he came across in this video, you know, he was telling an attending Garda to go and take her mask off for a wee photo opportunity, you know. And we just kind of went, wow, that's great stuff, you know. And actually, funny enough, to go to Roman's point about, how there wasn't how we felt that there wasn't a whole lot of adversarial or confrontational journalism, the Cork Echo had actually covered this event. I'm like, going, oh, like, isn't Micheál Martin great? And we were kind of like, really? Like, you know, and look, myself and Roman have kind of talked about this since, you know, and that was the first story that we published, and it did kind of come from, you know, having spoken about it all for whatever, 2 or 3 months, and it got to the point where we just said, right, we have to go and do this now and then keep on doing it, you know. We felt we had to launch with a big story, and I think that kind of story was the only kind of story that we could launch on. I do think, like, if the Irish Times or the Irish Independent had published that story, I think Micheál Martin would have been in serious, serious danger. We kind of, you know, we kind of were hurt a little bit by the fact that, you know, people were going, who the fuck are The Ditch, like, you know. Since then, yeah, we kind of just kept on at it, and kind of started off maybe a story a week or so, and then we kind of ramped it up a wee bit, and now Paulie's come on board the last half year or so, like, so hopefully only bigger and better things.
That's it. And speaking of yourself, Paulie, I mean, why is this work important?
The short answer is that there was a lack of stories in the Irish media identifying wrongdoing on the part of people in positions of power and authority, right? And I was quite struck by, you know, how successful the guys had been, just the two of them, at, you know, holding people to account, identifying wrongdoing, in opposition to what the Irish media, you know, for the most part does and has historically done, which is kind of run stories about politics that are focused on personalities or rely on government sources to kind of leak them stories so the narrative is kind of shaped a certain way. And so I think it's important to, that there are outlets out there that kind of hold people to account and that they run these kinds of stories. And yeah.
And has it been, because I know when you crack that wee word, it's the same, and I've seen it in film. How's the relationship between the likes of yourselves and others in journalism? Say for example, others that would have been comfortable with the status quo?
I think they're just kind of confused and vaguely annoyed by the emergence of the Ditch. There seems to be very much an attitude towards the Ditch that we're not somehow legitimate, right? You know, we'll run stories and the press will ignore them. And I think if they had another broadsheet had run them, they'd all end up kind of running them, if that makes sense. Sometimes the work that we do is acknowledged and other times it isn't. It seems to be kind of random in a way, you know.
I've got to say on that, like, I always kind of like it when you get, you know, a little bit of love or recognition from an unexpected source, you know, like where, you know, sometimes, yeah, I would agree with a lot of what Paulie has said, where there are mainstream journalists who don't like us or don't recognise us, whatever, and there are reasons for that, you know, but I found that was it the summer or was it kind of late spring when we had published all these stories about Niall Collins? Neil Martin gets up in the Dáil, goes on a diatribe, accuses us of being Russian assets, etc., etc., etc. And, you know, I was kind of surprised by... I went and did an interview with RTE after that, and it was kind of like... It was a guy called Justin Murphy, who, you know, I kind of knew it. I was kind of getting the 7 for, like, which is fine, you know, but, like... He kind of used the opportunity to hold me to account and kind of go, because Neil Martin had said that we're a political organisation, that, you know, we're not a, you know, a conventional journalistic outlet, you know, and I had to kind of answer for that, you know, whereas if it was a mainstream journalist, it would be, you know, it would be a, you know, grave attack on the press. And certainly some of the reaction post that attack on us by Micheál Martin was kind of, yeah, similar to what your man Justin Murphy was like. But I have to say, I very much respected Shane Ross in his Sunday Independent column that weekend. He called it out for what it was. You know, he called it out for an attack on the press, an attack on the media. He also, if I recall correctly, he compared Micheál Martin's rhetoric that day to be more fitting of someone like Putin, you know, in that it was an attack on the free press, you know. So I always enjoy that when, look, I wouldn't consider myself a liberal myself, you know, but I think when you do have... Sometimes, you know, people who actually abide by liberal principles like Shane Ross, like, I kind of did appreciate that, you know.
The good old Sunday Independent, eh? I'm sure some of you haven't had the misfortune of being called a troubled necrophiliac by the Sunday Independent.
Who was that in the...
That's for another day.
Was that RDE?
No. Yeah.
Sunday Independent isn't a political organisation, though. It's completely apolitical. Yeah, yeah. And they just stick to the facts and all that kind of thing. If I was a political journalist, I would be asking myself, well, why haven't I considered to be some sort of a political operator, you know?
Yeah, well, it's not political to uphold the status quo, but it is political to challenge it, yeah, you know.
And Micheál Martin wouldn't actually repeat what he said outside of the Dáil as well, crucially.
No,
well, that is crucial.
We have to give credit, though, to the established media for doing a great job of holding us to account.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, they might not want to hold the subjects of our stories to account, the people with actual power, but, yeah, they've certainly tried to hold us to account. It seems we only kind of get the phone call... you know, from RTE or other established media organisations, when we're in trouble, or they think we're in trouble, that's when they want to talk to us.
Of course.
You know, but when we've a big story,
you know, and someone else is in trouble, it, you know, they don't really want to hear from us.
Well, that's par for the course, as you well know now, Roman. Owen, just getting back to yourself, you had recently written a piece for Red Roof on the hate speech bill. Do you want to tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, look, I mean, I just think it's a terrible piece of legislation for so many reasons. It's a proposed hate speech act that it's working its way through the Oireachtas at the moment. It's gone through the Dáil, and it's to come before the Seanad. It's what can you say about it? It's, you know, it's incredibly far reaching. It effectively the parts that I'd be most worried about are the powers that it would give the Gardaí in investigating so-called hate offences, and the power that the guards would have for investigation of people's devices and homes. And part of this bill, you know, aims to combat transphobic hate crime, right? And as part of that, it would empower the Gardaí to investigate these potential crimes. But, you know, the Guards are an organisation that shelved an internal gender policy because, in the words of Antoinette Cunningham, who is she's a representative of one of the Gardaí unions, like, she said that a lot of the guards don't know about this kind of thing, like, you know, and that, you know, under this policy, you know, guards would have been possibly subject to disciplinary measures if they misgendered their colleagues, you know, and the guards say, oh no, like, we can't do this. Like, so, like, these are the guys that we're supposedly looking to combat these crimes. And I kind of find that the bit that I find that I continue to find most frustrating about it is the fact that the loudest opponents of this bill are generally from the right, and, you know, these are people who I said in the piece I wrote for you that, you know, these are people who have been in paroxysms of over phrases like from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free. You know, these people think that chant is beyond the pale, and they've been in hysterics over that. But now they're opposing this bill on the grounds of, they, as they would say, free speech. That's another kind of one that grinds my gears a wee bit. I always kind of find when Irish people talk about free speech, that to me is a bit of an Americanism. Like, I always think of freedom of expression. But anyway, I also just think that the left, or the nominal left, or the broad left, whatever you want to call it, has kind of ceded a lot of ground to the right in opposing this bill. And I think it's kind of wild in a country with our history of censorship, you know, on the censorship of even published discussion about abortion, and then particularly with Section 31, which I kind of do think that a lot of what you've been saying and what Paulie and Roman have been saying about this kind of whatever you want to call it, a toothlessness or a kind of an impotence of the Irish establishment media. I think it's a legacy of Section 31, where, you know, when, well, obviously Section 31 first introduced in, I think it was 1960, in the Broadcasting Act, and then it was later in the 70s where measures were introduced to ban Republicans from the airwaves. Effectively, there were different ministers involved, you know, but one minister who certainly came down hard and certainly used these measures quite prodigiously was Conor Cruise O'Brien, a man who later joined the UK Unionist Party. Like, but you can see, like, throughout the course of Section 31, you know, there are kind of, there were little, whatever you want to call it, you know, pockets of resistance to it, where I think there was one reporter who interviewed Sean McStiffan, and he interviewed him and then just read a transcript of what he had said. So technically, Sean McStiffan wasn't broadcast over the airwaves. This drove government mad, like, you know, and then they kind of clamped down on it again. The end result of this was government telling journalists what they can and can't publish. And, like, yeah, there were acts of resistance along the way, but broadly speaking, these guys just said, oh yeah, cool, Like, if Conor Cruz O'Brien says we shouldn't interview these guys, I'm going to go with him. And people get up on their high horse about this term, but I mean, if you can't call Conor Cruz O'Brien a West Brit, who can you call? You know, when he was just like... So, to me, it's just kind of crazy that, you know, anyone who considers themselves broadly progressive could support this bill. But then you'll see people then like Claire Byrne, who's an RTE presenter, she was questioning, she was interviewing Liam Herrick from the Irish Council for Civil Liberties. And, you know, one of the lines of questioning that she put to him was, oh, well, Donald Trump Jr. and Elon Musk oppose this. Are you happy to be in their corner? And it's just like, I don't know, it's just like, is that the extent of your feelings on this? That like, all right, well, these bad people are opposing it, we better oppose it too? You know, just kind of, yeah, I mean, like, I think, yeah, what I would like to see would be, you know, more progressive, liberal, left, socialist opposition to the bill, because it's a terrible piece of legislation anyway, but it's particularly bad in a country like Ireland.
So getting to the meat on the bones, start with you, Paulie. What, for the audience's sake, tell us about some of the big catches that you've had.
Well, the big story that we had this year was that Leo Varadkar had misled SIPO when they had asked him about a number of donations that were undeclared. Now, if you should explain that. So under the law, if you receive a donation from an individual that's or a company over 600 euro, you have to declare it, and that donation cannot exceed 1,000 euro, right? So SIPO wrote to him in 2019, and they said, Edelman bought a table at a fundraiser event that you ran. We found that it wasn't declared, so can you please explain that? Varadkar's explanation was that Edelman had been reimbursed by the individuals who were at the table, so therefore it didn't count as a donation exceeding 1,000 euro, and none of it had to be declared because they were, you know, 100 euro, 200 euro apiece. SIPO then checked with Edelman, and they said, is this what happened here? Edelman wrote back and said, no, actually, that's not what happened. And that then brought something that Leo Varadkar had said explaining a donation from them in 2022 into question as well. There were other undeclared donations from 2018 that year. One of them was from a barrister. One of them was from the Attorney General, well, the now Attorney General, Rossa Fanning. And the other one was from Centric Health, right? And they asked, SIPO wrote to Leo saying, are you satisfied? Now, he'd given the same explanation for, you know, these other donations, saying they were all reimbursed, so I didn't have to declare them. They'd written to him saying, you know, can you explain, one, why Edelman are contradicting you, and two, you know, are you satisfied that this explanation, you know, accounts for what's happened with these other donations? And he just ignored them, right? Because Leo Varadkar doesn't have to answer questions to anyone, apparently. He doesn't have to. So he just refused to.
And it's SIPO as well.
And it's SIPO as well, which is completely toothless, yeah. Right? So he just said, instead of engaging with them and accounting for what he'd done, he was just like, no, I'm not going to answer that. And then they wrote to him again. And we did a story on it. And we asked him about it. And Leo Varadkar then released a statement to us saying, I can confirm that I am not under investigation by SIPO, which was I think he was trying to get off on a kind of a technical term, because it was like an inquiry and maybe not technically an investigation or something like that.
Response.
Well, we actually never said he was under investigation. We were careful with the language because of how the legislation is worded, and we said that it was, we used words like probe and everything.
SIPO is investigating, which is the language that the mainstream press use whenever SIPO stick an oar into Sinn Féin's business. It's always, oh, SIPO is investigating, but... Can't say about Leo Varadkar.
So this as well, though, that was one of the instances where the media did pick it up, and they ran with the headline, Leo Varadkar confirms that he is not under investigation by SIPO. And there was also one journalist who's quite well known, who contacted us kind of asking for what we had to back up, you know, what we said in the story. So, you know, we kind of, you know, made sure that we sent it on to him, and he didn't do anything with it, so I'm convinced that it was a fact-finding mission.
Sounds like it. And yourself, Roman, what would you say would be one of the biggest stories that you've worked on?
I'd say probably my favourite story last year was the Niall Collins story that we did. So Niall Collins is a junior minister. He's the Minister of State for Further Education. And the first story that we did, I think, was at the beginning of last year, related to a planning application that he had made, a historic planning application. And basically on that planning application, he lied and said that he was living with his parents in order to circumvent planning rules, very strict planning rules, relating to one-off dwellings. He wanted to build a one-off dwelling in Limerick, where he's from. And the problem was he already owned a house, so he didn't have a housing need. So in order to get around that, as I said, he basically just lied. And he said he was living with his parents, he didn't own any property, and he got planning permission to build that house. I mean, some people would say, that there's, and it is quite controversial, you know, the one-off housing rules, they still exist. And a lot of people would say that, you know, they're problematic. And I think a lot of people would tell fibs on the applications to kind of get around these things. But, you know, this guy is a lawmaker, and a lot of people who do things like that would have to face consequences for it. So we ran that story, and I guess he kind of managed to weasel his way out of it. And the media kind of ran with whatever he was saying. He came into the Dáil and gave a statement, and, you know, I think he thought that was the end of it. We did a little bit more digging, and it turned out that his wife had purchased a parcel of land in Limerick that was owned by the council, and a month before the council voted to sell that piece of land, his wife had written in to the council and said, I want to buy this piece of land. He voted. He was one of the people that voted. His Fianna Fáil colleagues proposed the motion at a council meeting. He was a councillor at the time. And they voted to sell the piece of land, which his wife then bought. And basically, no consequences. He's still a minister. There is a Garda investigation into it. I believe it's not an investigation stage. They've said that they're doing a scoping exercise to see if any legislation was broken, which it seems it might have been, the Local Government Act, which states you have to recuse yourself when, you know, you've a potential beneficial interest. And there's also a complaint made to the Standards and Public Office Commission. But he's still junior minister for further education. And there were a lot of other stories that we did on Niall Collins. A lot of, you know, I would say dodgy dealings, relating to himself. And he hasn't really had to properly account for any of it, you know.
Listen, lads, it's great to have you up in Belfast. What we're going to do now is we're going to leave the studio and work on our plans over the next coming month. And I'm looking forward to it. So, Owen, Paulie, Roman, thank you for coming to the show.
Thank you very much. Thanks.
And that does it for another week. We'd love for you to join the conversation by sharing the link to today's programme to help us grow our audience across all our social media platforms. I'd once again like to thank our special guests, Owen McNeill, Paulie Doyle and Roman Shorthall from The Ditch. In the meantime, the conversation will be back next week with more investigations and analysis. I'm Sean Murray. Bye for now.
In the limelight.
For those who were moving between primary and secondary school during the coronavirus pandemic, Lockdowns also disrupted integration into new social groups and the chance to form friendships. We take a look at some of the world press and media